Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Well, welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast, and we have a loaded podcast for you today. Three guests coming up today, and we begin with Bobby Marks, the front office insider over at the Vertical. We go into some draft chatter with Bobby. We talk about the future of Chris Bosch, and of course, we touch a little bit on what we expect to see in the finals. But we get deeper into the finals a little bit later in the pod. Two beat writers that cover the Warriors and the Cavaliers. Anthony Slater does a great job covering Golden State for the Bay Area News Group. We talked to Anthony about the Kevin Durant effect, about the absence of Steve Kerr, among other things. And then Jason Lloyd, who covers the Cavaliers for The Athletic. We talked to Jason about the Cavaliers' defense. How vulnerable is it? And what would a win over Golden State mean for the legacy of LeBron James? Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, there's a very easy way you can support it. Head over to Apple Podcast, also known as iTunes, leave a comment, post a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure we do this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. Joining me on the pod now, Bobby Marks, the front office insider over at The Vertical. He's the former assistant GM of the Brooklyn Nets. Been a long time in that organization. Bobby, what's going on, man, as we are in finals week, finally?
Oh, good, Chris. I had two bears in my garbage this morning at 6 a.m., and they enjoyed my wife's peach cobbler. So that was something interesting to wake up to see.
Man, you are so old now. You're just in Florida making peach cobbler. I mean, don't you miss being a New Yorker to some degree? I mean, you were a Jerseyer for the most part, but you were a Northeast guy. Now you're just this sort of like quasi-retired co-podcaster with me down in Florida.
Oh, I know. I'm a big fan of those 5 o'clock specials, you know.
We got plenty of time for that this week as no games take place until Thursday. We got another interminable layoff in between games. And there's a lot I want to get into with you, Bobby, but this finals matchup, do you see it being that uber competitive, savior of the playoffs type of matchup? Because I think everyone out there is kind of crossing their fingers, hoping we get one of those seven game wars that makes us forget what absolute junk we've been watching so far.
Well, how good does it get from last year, though? I mean, from the going to game seven, a Kyrie Irving jump shot less than a minute to go, and a team that was down, 3-1 to come back. I mean, can you top that? I don't know. I don't think you can. I think the teams are better, though, Chris. I think this Golden State team is better with Durant. I think this Cleveland team is better with their – I think their bench is better than a year it was. So, and they both pretty much have sailed through the playoffs. So, does Golden State jump out to a 2-0 lead and, kind of put the, hammer home when they go into Cleveland? I mean, that's certainly a scenario that could play out. I mean, if Cleveland's going to win the series, it's not going to be quick. I mean, this is going to be for them to do, it could be 6 or 7. But I can see Golden State, I can see them winning in 5 possibly.
Yeah, I could see that too, because of how good the Warriors are and how much better they are with Kevin Durant on the floor. And Kevin Durant's going to make shots this year that Harrison Barnes was missing last year. But let's assume the opposite happens, that Cleveland wins. And in a hot topic, a narrative for the last week or so has been, LeBron's place alongside Michael Jordan. Where does he stand? To me, this is, if LeBron can beat Golden State, that will serve as his most, his signature accomplishment, beating the Warriors, a team that was 73 wins last year and added a Kevin Durant to that mix. That would be a signature, top of the resume type accomplishment. And I know that we can't really have a formal discussion about LeBron and Jordan until LeBron's career is over, which may not be for a long time, but if he can get championship number 4 against this Golden State team, I don't know how you don't have them kind of shoulder to shoulder in the annals of history.
This would be his best accomplishment yet, and that's saying a lot as far as how many finals he's been to, because I think when I look at this Golden State team, this team, although they didn't win the record games that the team from last year won, this is a better team you know, hands down for me. I think that even their bench is better there. So, but this is going to be a mountain to come over. I mean, this is going to be, I mean, pick your poison, 1-4, and then you have Iguodala and McCall and Clark, and you got some veterans with David West there. So, this Cleveland team is going to have to be at A+. In every game here, you're not going to be able to afford a lapse that you did in that Boston series, second half, third game, and the first half of the fourth game.
All right, I want to talk about some of the teams whose seasons are over right now, and all these teams are kind of preparing for the draft and for free agency, and for them, that's how they can take that next step to get on that Cleveland Golden State level. And let's start with Boston there. All the consensus out there among the draftniks is that Markelle Fultz is by far and away the best player in the draft. If Boston's taking the best player on the board, they're taking Markelle Fultz. I mean, from the people you talk to across the league, I mean, is it a no-brainer? Is he the guy at number one?
He is right now. I don't see it changing when we get to June 22nd. There's clear enough separation between himself and Lonzo Ball. Josh Jackson from Kansas, Jason Tatum, Jonathan Isaacs, the Kentucky guards, with Monk and Fox. But there's some separation there, and I don't see, unless something comes back on Fultz's background and there's a red flag, and from the teams I've talked to, he's pretty clear right now. There's nothing that stands out, especially from a physical standpoint. There's nothing there. Boston will take him if they still retain their pick, or they should take him. I don't want to speak for Danny Ainge, but they should take him because he is the best available player.
Yeah, no question. I think that's pretty clear at this point. And look, he's the kind of guy, and we've discussed this before, but people are wondering, is it Fultz or Isaiah Thomas? I think you can play them alongside each other right from the start and then figure it out kind of from there. So we know most likely Fultz at number one. Most likely Lonzo Ball at number two. Number three, Bobby, is where I think it could get interesting, because I think that Brian Colangelo is itching to make a deal. I mean, Brian is not the same type of GM that Sam Hankey was. I mean, he respects the process and isn't trying to become a championship team right away, but he wants to get moving here. And, they've got a lot of young players on that Sixers roster already, talented top three level young players. I think if there's an opportunity for Philadelphia to get experienced, quality, high-level talent that's ready to win right now, that third overall pick can be had. If you're a big fan of a Jackson or a Tatum or a De'Aaron Fox, you can move up, I think, and get that pick away from the 76ers. And I don't know how prudent you think that is for the Sixers to make a deal like that, but I think Colangelo wants to win, and I think he sees an opportunity to maybe make the playoffs next year if Embiid's healthy, if Simmons develops the way we think he's going to. I think he sees an opportunity to sneak into that 7-8 seed as early as next season.
I only see three players on that team who are untouchable, Embiid, Simmons, and Saric. I think you could put Covington in a separate column. I don't see him being moved, his salary so low. They're almost like Boston without the track record from a success standpoint, where they've got so many different ways you can go with that team. You've got third pick overall. You've got that Laker pick next year in 2018. You've got a Kings pick in 2019. You've got an Oklahoma City pick down the road, and you've got probably about $40 million in cap space, and really don't have to become creative in doing your books, so you can go in so many different directions. And for a team that's not been in the playoffs for over 4 years now, do you have the patience to kind of walk this thing along, or are you kind of going to be willing to jump in here at the draft from acquiring a veteran, moving that pick, maybe move back here in the draft? I mean, I would still advise, if you're going to move it, you still got to stay in the top 10 somehow. But can you maybe get a veteran player that maybe has to have some years on their contract? So that's where I see it with Philadelphia there. So, you're looking at three, there's a range of guys, Chris, from, besides the top two guys, from three to like in that eight, nine range. That you can get, there's so much good talent. I mean, we haven't talked about Jonathan Isaacs from Florida State, who you can make a case for three. Tatum's there. You know, Jackson's there. You know, the Kentucky kids, Dennis Smith from NC State. That moving back, and if you can get another asset or another player, you know, is something certainly you got
to
look at.
If you're Philadelphia, if you're trying to continue to build organically and build the conventional way, I think De'Aaron Fox is probably the right guy. I mean, Fox, we saw the way he played, not just in the tournament, but all season, but in that tournament, the way he played against Lonzo Ball in that matchup, he was great. And those types of matchups, I think, resonate with executives. But there's a lot, not really a lot of clarity about how they want to play. I mean, you know, Brett Brown continues to double down on the idea that Ben Simmons is going to be a point guard. And if that's the case, I mean, what's the best fit for that position then? I mean, Bobby, do you go out and get a two guard masquerading as a one who can defend ones? Do you go out and find the best shooters available to play in your backcourt? I mean, how much faith would you have in Ben Simmons' ability, and that faith kind of manifests itself in how you build the roster, but how much faith do you have in his ability to play point guard as often and as many minutes as the Sixers seem to think he can play?
None. I don't, because I don't know. I mean, I know what he was at LSU, and I know what he was at least during the summer. And he's kind of a positionless player who's very good with the ball, but is still a player who missed a year after a foot injury. So if it's an experiment and we're going to see him maybe play some point guard here, I don't think he can guard once. I think he'll have a hard time there. And then if you look at the roster, you've got Jared Bayless. You've got TJ McConnell as your backup. Certainly, you know, either one can start, but can they start in a, you know, at a high level for 82 games and try to make this team into a playoff team? So I don't see that. And then you go to, you know, then are you willing to take a point guard at three? You know, and that's where kind of, you know, Fox comes into play. You know, I don't think if you move back farther in the lottery, he'll still be there. So in that window is at 3 to 5 range. So and then you also have cap space to address the point guard position. But are you willing to go out and pay, you know, Kyle Lowry $30 million if you think Simmons eventually could be your point guard? I don't see that as possible. So I think that injury to Simmons certainly clouded a lot of things last year, where you missed a year where, if he was healthy, played, you know, 70 games here, at least he gives you an indication as far as what you have going into this summer.
Kyle Lowry doesn't make any sense to me on either level, on either for Lowry or even the 76ers, because, yeah, he might fortify that position in the short term. He might help you get to that 7-8 seed range, but you're probably going to be paying him, what, like $35, $40 million on the back end of that deal, because he's not coming on a hometown discount, that's for sure. You're going to be paying him an exorbitant amount of money at like 35 years old, almost 36. That just doesn't seem to fit with what the Sixers are trying to do. On the same token, why would Kyle Lowry leave any kind of potential money on the table from Toronto to play for a team that's never going to win? Now, you can say the Raptors aren't there, and I'll agree with you, but the Sixers, you know, sure as shit aren't there right now.
What I learned, Chris, is they don't give you trophies during the offseason for your biggest signings, and you know, you sometimes get caught up in the emotion of a contract and you forget about years 3, 4, and 5, or you're for Philly at least years 3 and 4 if you're gonna offer a big time contract. And that, I know you can have some short term success maybe this year or next year, but when you're staring that number down and it's, you know, $38-40 million, that's a big number. Toronto's a little bit different there. You know, there's a lot of money on the table there, and I'm sure there'll be a fair offer from Masai, and they, you know, if for where they are at their level, they can't afford to lose them, because now you're looking at, you know, Corey Joseph and DeLon Wright. So I think there's more incentive for Lowry to return to Toronto. And for him, I don't know. I know he's returning home, but I mean, how much do you want to be in a rebuild on your last contract there? Mm-hmm. Because it's going to take you a couple years. I don't, you know, getting into the playoffs, maybe you can sneak into 8, but to get into that top 4 and try to, you know, compete with some of these teams, if, you know, Cleveland stays intact down the road, it's going to take a long time here.
Now, we are you buying into the possibility that either a Kyle Lowry or a Chris Paul could find their way to San Antonio?
I know I'm not. I have a hard time believing in that. I don't see that as the Spurs way. I know we can turn back to LaMarcus Aldridge in you know, a couple years ago, and even the Gasol contract from last year. I mean, that's a smaller deal. That was a 2-year deal. Aldridge was a max out, and RC, and but I never doubt RC be able to create cap space. But I don't see how it's possible. Let's say I'm going to put it out there. It's not. Let's say it's certainly possible. But The way they'd have to go about doing so is that, you know, Gasol likely is going to opt into this contract. So you opt in and then he's going to have to be moved. And then you're going to have to really start gutting this group here. It's, you know, a team that has been so loyal to their own, Ginobili, Duncan, you know, are you willing to cut bait with Tony Parker or waive him or stretch him? Mm-hmm. That's hard for me to, you know, kind of stomach right now. Are you willing to move it possibly a Danny Green? You know, Gasol would have to be traded. You wouldn't be able to bring out Corey Joseph, or, you know, you could probably bring back Jonathan Simmons. So when the dust clears, and if it's Lowry or Paul, those are your targets, then you're staring with either one of those point guards, Kawhi Leonard, maybe Danny Green, and LaMarcus Aldridge, and your young kids, you know, Deonte Murray, Davis Bertans, you know, your first round pick this year. And how much better is that group than it was, you know, a year ago that won, you know, a lot of games here. So that's where my concern would be.
Yeah, they've always believed in San Antonio that the system was as important, if not more important, than the players, with a few exceptions, of course, Kawhi, LaMarcus Aldridge, as you mentioned. But they didn't have to gut the roster for LaMarcus Aldridge, as you pointed out. I mean, they moved Tiago Splitter, whose career is basically over, in to create the cap space to sign Aldridge. Gutting their team, that just doesn't seem like a San Antonio kind of thing to do. All right, let's talk about a team that's already been gutted, and that being the Sacramento Kings, which is actually a kind of a good thing, I think, in this moment, Bobby, because they're not beholden to position. They're not beholden to finding players that fit best around LaMarcus Aldridge. They can use these two top 10 picks to draft the best players on the board, and to me, this is kind of... this is high noon for Vlade Divac. This is where he either makes or breaks himself as an executive, because I think you and I can both maybe agree here that inside the lottery, either, you know, in that range, you're going to find 7-8 guys probably that turn into either starters or all-stars, or in the case of some, even better. And we're going to look back like we did with Kawhi Leonard, or we did with Steph Curry, like we did with Klay Thompson, and see a bunch of players that were drafted before them or after them that didn't make a heck of a lot of sense. This is a major moment, I think, for Vlade. He has got a hit on both these draft picks to give Sacramento a chance to dig themselves out of this mess that they're in right now.
Biggest draft in Kings franchise history.
Hey, there we go.
I'll put the pressure on them.
Now we're talking.
Now, and it is. I mean, it really is. I mean, I know what you did last year, and I understood, you know, when we did the show, I understood the philosophy where you were trading, you know, out to get, you know, a couple, I guess, two or three picks from Phoenix. But, I mean, you wind up missing out on probably Marquise Chris, who could be, you know, could be a really good player here. Yeah. And can you imagine keeping him in with your, you know, the picks that you have right now, 5 and 10? Can you imagine that base of players there? I mean, that's a nice starting point there. It's very similar to you know, Golden State, where the, you know, how they built that team with Curry, then Thompson, and you know, Green was the second round pick. But you need to nail these picks here, because they're going to be your recruiting point when you are trying to attract free agents, you know, 4 years from now or 3 years from now, based on how these kids develop. Because your free agents are not coming to Sacramento, mm-hmm, right now. I mean, they're not. I mean, cap space. Yeah, cap space is appealing, but there's not a base there from a selling point there. So, if you have a De'Aaron Fox at pick 5, let's say, or a you are a Markman, you know, at you know, pick 10, the kid from Arizona, you know, do those guys, you know, develop into the next, you know, Kristaps Porzingis, or the next John Wall, or the next, you know, some of these players that are all stars, and that's going to be your sell there. So you've got to do your homework here, and you've got to nail these guys.
Yeah, and look, if De'Aaron Fox is sitting there at number 5, that's a no-brainer, because, you know, they need a point guard. He's the best point guard in the field by far. My question is, does De'Aaron Fox get by Phoenix at number 4? Because the Suns, you know, it was widely assumed they would take Alonzo Ball at 2 to play him alongside, or Fultz or whoever was at that 1-2 slot to play alongside Devin Booker. Is Fox not kind of the right fit for them there as well? I know he's not a shooter or an offensive-oriented player, but, I mean, think of the pace that Phoenix could play with Fox and Devin Booker as that backcourt. And we know now just how important having a quality point guard is. I don't know. That makes some sense to me at 4, even with guys like Tatum and Jackson still on the board.
Well, it comes down, and then it comes down to, you know, Ryan McDonough's, what his philosophy is. It, you know, is there enough separation in this year's draft when you start doing your board in a couple of weeks from now, when you get closer to the draft, where it's based on best available or need? And if it's, and if Fox out, you know, is, you know, there's so much separation between him and Tatum and Jackson, you know, the rest of that group there, then you draft the best available. And if it's Fox, even though you've got, you know, Bledsoe, and you've got to figure out what you want to do with Brandon Knight, and you've got Tyler Ulis, so you've got point guards already there. But as I say, you know, you draft the best available. You know, you don't say, well, let's move back to six, because you don't know if he's going to be there at six. And then you figure out what you want to do. I know the Knight contract's hard to move there, but you have to factor in that this player, whoever you draft, is not going to be here for 1 or 2 years. This is a likely an 8 or 9 year investment.
Yeah, you really do have to look at that, because this team is ways away from doing anything significant in the conference. A little bit further down, Bobby, as I look at the most interesting of the lottery range type of picks, you got the Knicks sitting there at number 8, and they certainly could use a point guard. But I just wonder, are they going to take a point guard, a dynamic point guard potentially, a scoring type of point guard, and put him into that triangle system and force him to play a system that he's clearly unfamiliar with playing? If you look at Draft Express's mock draft right now, they've got Dennis Smith at number 8, the point guard out of NC State, going to the New York Knicks. Dennis Smith was a scoring point guard last year, averaged 18 points per game with the Wolfpack. I don't know, man. It just, you know, I understand taking the best player on the board, but if you're taking a point guard and you're going to force him to play an uncomfortable system like the triangle, it just to me seems like it's a recipe for disaster.
Any other team at 8 and you need a point guard, I would advise them taking Dennis Smith. If you're New York, I don't know. I mean, you're right. I mean, he's an explosive scoring point guard. I think he's a capable playmaker, but he still lacks a lot of polish there. So you throw him into that system, and what are you basing it on, that he can, you know, run the triangle here? You've got 1 year for an NC State team that fired the coach mid-year, and you miss out on the tournament. And so you're going to really have to dive into, from a tape standpoint, you're going to have to, you know, what does the individual visit tell you? Is the player be able to pick up, you know, what Jeff Hornacek is trying to teach out there? I mean, how much does, you know, an hour and a half kind of time frame do that for you? So, but I still think they need a point guard. I think it's easier to get a point guard in the draft than it is in free agency. I don't see them getting one of these big name guys out, you know, that's a, you know, top 8, you know, heavy point guard. Holiday, I wouldn't bring Derrick Rose back, George Hill, that group there. So you get a draft a point guard, figure out, you know, if he can learn the system, even if there's some hesitancy there still, I still think you go that route, and then you get a veteran point guard in free agency that maybe can kind of act as a tutor here.
You know, I'd be tempted if I was the Knicks, and I've only seen a little bit of this kid on film, but Markkanen out of Arizona. Think about the kind of just, you know, versatile scoring front court you could put together with him and with Kristaps Porzingis on that front line. You got 2 7-foot-plus big men who can both shoot the three. Like, that's the type of diverse front court that can create just an enormous number of offensive mismatches.
Imagine stretching that floor out and putting both those guys in a corner.
Seriously, your guards can be your post players. I mean, even if you did want to keep Carmelo Anthony, which I don't see happening, but if you did want to keep Carmelo, you could have, you know, there'd be no way for bigs to stay in the paint to help out on him, because you've got two guys, at least in theory, that could camp out around the 3-point line and be, you know, 35-40% type threats from beyond the arc. I mean, that's a dangerous type of mismatch for that team.
Well, you're right. I mean, and you can put him at the 4. I mean, I think he's got a defined role right now. He's a stretch 4.
Yeah.
You know, talking with teams that his teammates loved him at Arizona. I mean, they really did. So there, you know, there's a fit from a locker room standpoint. And then, if you want to, you put Porzingis maybe at the 5. And you kind of go from there. Here's a kid who you can kind of throw in right now because he's got a defined skill.
Are you a believer in Porzingis as a long-term 5? I mean, I've been saying for a couple of years now that it would behoove the Knicks to put him at the five right now and start to build that kind of Dirk Nowitzki type mismatch where Dirk was reinvented that four position. I could see Porzingis doing the same thing at the five spot. Are you a believer in him as a five?
I still am, and hopefully the Joakim Noah injury and suspension whenever he comes back gives Porzingis or Hornacek the opportunity to experiment with Porzingis at the five there. You still have Herring Gomez, you've got Kylo Quinn, some of your bigs there. So I think there's a strict five. I think, but there's certain points in the game where you can play him there.
Yeah, I think he's got to be there. I think as his body fills out, Bobby, it's going to be. It's going to make more and more sense. Now, he's got to get better. I think the idea of Porzingis and the potential of Porzingis is a little bit more substantive than the reality of him right now. He still is not a great three-point shooter. He has great three-point shooting nights, and it looks like he's going to develop into one. But I would just love to see them take this sort of patient approach and do with Porzingis. Like I mentioned Dirk, but I think Durant is another great example. Like Durant, his early years in Oklahoma City, they really used Dirk as a comparable, and they really tried to teach Durant put him in places where Dirk was. They started him at the nail, the top of the key there, and figured like with his wingspan, his shot-making ability inside the three-point line, he could make that mid-range jump shot and get to the basket. I think the same thing should be done with Porzingis, which brings us back to the fact that it probably won't, because they're going to try to play the god-freaking-damn triangle all the time and screw with this kid's potential.
I know. But it's funny. We used the Princeton offense in New Jersey when Byron was there the years we went to the finals, the 2 years there. And you've got to have a five that can pass the ball. I think Porzingis can do that. We didn't use it to – we were such a team that got up and down that we used it more from a transition standpoint. So that's why when people say, when Hornacek or Phil Jackson talks about the triangle, I think it's part of it, but I don't think it can be the end-all be-all there.
All right, let me finish with just one thought from you on Chris Bosh and his future. It was reported that the Heat are coming to an agreement with Bosh that'll make him a free agent. They'll get cap relief, and basically Bosh can try to do whatever it is he wants to try to do without them kind of being responsible for it at this point. I mean, is there, in your opinion, is there any chance that Bosh plays in the NBA again?
I don't see it, Chris. I really don't. I mean, it's interesting to see when this this kind of comes to a resolution here with how it's the wording from the amendment or the I guess it's a buyout here where they'll waive him and they'll get cap relief. I mean, it's 25 and $26.8 million. Because if you had waited, and the reason why this is kind of coming to a head right now is we're kind of in that in-between stage of the 2011 CBA that expires on June 30th and the new CBA that starts on July 1, the 2017 CBA. And there's a clause in this new one where you have a fitness panel that for a guy who suffered a career-ending type injury that you would go before this fitness panel, Bosh would certainly hit that criteria. And if you're deemed, your career is, career ending from a blood clot, that you would be, not eligible to play. You wouldn't be able to review your case for, either 9 months or a year or the first game of the season. So, but they're able to do it now, it looks like, because they've kind of reached an agreement between both sides and the Players Association. So where does Bosh fit in now? Does he still have to wait a 9 month window or possibly even a year to next season? Miami will get the cap relief, but can he kind of come back and sign with another team right now? So that's kind of we're a little bit of in a gray area. I think we kind of need to see how that plays out here, but I don't see a team signing him. I think there's so much of a health risk there. And I wouldn't be shocked if, how much the league has a role in, from a doctor standpoint, where it's not going to be cut and dry that a team, based on their own physician is allowed to sign him outright without consent from the NBA.
Yeah, I think people, maybe they don't forget, but it's pretty clear to me that if Bosh could play, Miami would welcome him onto the roster. This is not a team that's eager for that cap relief. They want to play and they want to win, as we saw last year. So, with no Bosh, with Bosh not being healthy enough to play, I have a hard time seeing another team being able to slip that past the NBA or anybody in terms of clearing him. All right, Bobby, appreciate it, man. Thanks, as always, for joining me here.
Thanks, Chris. Have a great day.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
My thanks to Bobby Marks for joining the show. Before we get to Anthony Slater, I've got to tell my listeners about the art of shaving. And anybody that knows me knows that I hate to shave. I'm sitting here recording this podcast right now with a probably 4 or 5 day old stubble, which comes from not having to do any TV or anything like that before the start of the NBA Finals. But eventually, I'm going to have to do that TV. And eventually, I'm going to have to shave. And when I do shave, I always use the art of shaving. It is the secret to a well-groomed guy. Founded in New York in 1996, the Art of Shaving has been helping guys look their best for over 20 years. It has your total routine covered, whether shaving, beard maintenance, hair, skin, body, fragrance, you name it, they got it. The Art of Shaving's award-winning products are formulated with the highest quality botanical ingredients featuring pure essential oils. The four elements of the perfect shave have been created to deliver smooth results every single day. You start by prepping the skin with their signature pre-shave oil, then create a thick, foamy lather with shaving cream applied with a shave brush, shave, then replenish moisture with their aftershave balm. Finish off the perfect shave with one of their 5 fragrances, each cologne carefully assembled for their distinctive scent. The Art of Shaving offers a convenient replenishment service that allows you to save on your favorite products while never having to worry. All right, here's how you get it. Our listeners will receive 15% off their first order and free shipping by using the promo code MANIX. To get this offer, go online to theartofshaving.com, use my special promo code MANIX to get 15% off your first order and free shipping. Visit theartofshaving.com for this special offer, or for a consultation with a grooming expert, step into one of their many retail locations near you. Joining me on the pod now, Anthony Slater, San Jose Mercury News beat writer, covers the Golden State Warriors out in Oakland. Anthony, thanks for joining me, man.
No problem. Thanks for having me. I'm ready to finally get the season going.
Oh, it's interminable, isn't it? It's just this. I understand why they do it, but the 9 days or whatever it is off between games 1 and 2, it's just too long. But on that note, I mean, good for Golden State. You know, and they've had so much time off in between series already. This another extended layoff, do you see it as being a positive for this team?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Draymond Green's put it best when asked about it. He's like, I'll take a quarter of rust for a week of rest. And, you know, they've now had 3 weeks of rest in the playoffs. 19 games in 63 days is going to end up what it's being at the start of game one. Just look at the minutes played, I mean, compared to last year. I mean, remember this team heading into the finals last year? Off of game 7, they only had 2 days off. Curry's got the knee issue. Draymond Green has the flagrant point issue. You know, Iguodala has the back thing. They'd ended up playing, I think Klay Thompson had played 200-something more playoff minutes. Draymond Green the same. Kevin Durant, who obviously wasn't in the finals. Last year he played 734 minutes through the West Finals. This year he's played 334. So it's basically a team that's, you know, their bodies are about second round-ish right now. So I think it's good that they're this fresh, even if it gives them maybe a quarter of rust.
Rust and rest. It's like Draymond should be a writer.
Yeah.
He's just a walking soundbite.
Yeah, he really is.
All right, let's start with Steve Kerr here and the possibility of him coaching in the finals, the problems the Warriors could have if he doesn't. What do we know at this point about Steve Kerr's back? And really, how big a deal is it if it turns out Mike Brown is the coach every game of this series and not Kerr?
Well, look, Steve surprisingly came and talked to reporters on Monday, which, when he's walking over, I'm like, wow, is he really going to announce he's coming back? But it ends up Mike Brown has the flu. He's just kind of filling in, updating people on his status. He is holding out hope. He said he's still looking for that, like, aha moment. It's very unlikely he's going to coach in the finals. I mean, because so he's had this, it stems from this back surgery that actually, you know, ironically happened 2 years ago in the finals when he's jumping to argue a call. He gets the ruptured disc, but it isn't a back thing anymore. It's just when he had the surgery, spinal tap fluid. Now it's just like chronic headaches and pain. He can't sit still very well. That's been the issue the last 2 years, really, you know, accelerated during the Portland series. That's why he stepped away. And he says, you know, he is feeling a little bit better. He's maybe to the point where he can probably push through it. But they're so worried about his life moving forward that I don't see – I mean, if he's showing progress, I don't think it's wise to put him back on the sidelines during the NBA Finals in the same situation he originally hurt the back in 2 years ago. Where, I mean, you know how the music in the arena is. They're super crowded suddenly. Mm. So I don't think he'll coach as far as how big a deal is it. I don't think we know to this point because Steve Kerr's been a part of every strategy basically – throughout the playoffs, a little bit, not really in the Jazz series. They've rumbled through a ton of teams. But the only thing Mike Brown hasn't shown yet is in-game coaching. He hasn't really had to. They've been blowing teams out. 10 of their 12 wins are by double digits. So I think we'll know if it's game one, it's close, it's down the stretch, and there's a big decision, maybe a rotation decision that Mike Brown has to make.
Yeah, and that's certainly the great unknown. We thought we might have a series in that game one of the Spurs series, but obviously what happened with Kawhi Leonard, and it went that direction. You know, I remember back in 2014, Anthony, when the Spurs got back into the finals, and you knew all season long they were motivated by what happened the year before, getting beat at the end of that series. You know, remember, we all remember the rope being lined up to celebrate San Antonio's win. The Spurs used that, you know, all that next year, and it paid off in the end. How motivated do you think this Warriors team is by what happened last year?
Very, and I think it's got a guy, but I'd say the rope being put around is basically the 3-1 jokes for the Warriors, is what I'd probably translate it to. But yeah, they've been ridiculed all year. For Steph Curry, it's that he kind of, you know, I don't want to say melted down in the finals, but he didn't have a good finals at all. Kyrie Irving outplayed him. Klay Thompson had big shots hit on him by Kyrie Irving. You know, the cookies that Klay Thompson jokes about that were at the, you know, the Halloween thing. Mm-hmm. And then for Draymond Green, I think it's just game five. And because he was actually by far the best player, maybe even on the court, but really on the Warriors in game seven. I think he had 6 threes. But in game five, obviously, he gets a suspension that swings the series. He's having to hear about all that all summer. And then Kevin Durant has his own personal motivations for different reasons that have nothing to do with 3-1. So I think everyone differently has motivation. But, I mean, this is a very, you know, not just relaxed, but you know, ready-to-go squad, I think, for the finals just because of last year.
You know, it's funny. Everyone is kind of hoping for and expecting, really, this final series to make up for the just slop we've had to deal with in the postseason up until this point. But, I mean, how likely is it or how possible is it, do you think, that we don't get a competitive series? I mean, Golden State was a 73-win team last year. They had a top-five player. I mean, they did choke away a 3-1 lead, and we give credit to the Cavaliers for doing that. But I don't know. I think in the back of my mind, Anthony, I think there's a possibility we could get like a five, maybe six-game series tops with Golden State winning here.
Yeah, I think that's the NBA's fear. And to me, it really kind of just comes down to Cleveland's defense, right? Because both teams have incredible offenses. You know, Warriors best in the league this year efficiency-wise, around 113 points per 100 possessions. Cavs in a similar realm. The Cavs have been in the playoffs, I think they're around 120, which is a crazy number. But the Warriors' defense is at 99.1, which is a great number, where the Cavs, I think, are around 105 this year. They were bottom 10 defense. Can they stop the Warriors enough? Are they able to play Korver and Fry and kind of extract that shooting from them? And some of the one-sided players they have, are they able to have two or three of those on the floor at the same time with, you know, the weapons the Warriors just have, you know, everywhere, and still be able to stay in a game? I'm concerned, you know, about that. They beat the Warriors on Christmas because they had 18 offensive rebounds. I think they ended up shooting 18 more times. That's the Warriors' issue. You turn them over, you really beat them up on the glass. Then suddenly you get, you know, maybe 10 to 15 more shots than them. Then the efficiency that they kill other teams with, you kind of take that away. And maybe then the Cavs linger in a game like they did on Christmas Day. And then the Warriors have shown at times this season down the stretch in a close game, you know, they might have issues. Who's going to shoot it? And then you steal a game in Oracle, and then they get really tight, and they start thinking about the demons of last year. And maybe Durant has a struggle, and he's getting a lot of pressure. I think LeBron just wants to get this to six in Cleveland. You get it to six in Cleveland, I think anything can happen.
Yeah, and you mentioned the offensive rebounds. Those are the two. There's two paths I see for Cleveland winning here. One is Tristan Thompson runs buck wild. He had 27 offensive rebounds last year in the finals. He's been great for most of the postseason. He was just, I mean, I watched every game live that he played against the Celtics, and I mean, he was just bulldozing some of those guys, and I think he can do the same thing to some of the bigs in Golden State. And, you know, how physical the refs let these games be played. I mean, Cleveland is the more physical team. I mean, you have Draymond on one side. The other side, you've got LeBron, you got Tristan Thompson. You know, I think Kevin Love can bang more than some of those Warriors guys can bang. I think what the refs allow these two teams to get away with is going to dictate what happens in this series.
Yeah, and, you know, that's where I think a big reason. Look, they're always, anytime you can get Kevin Durant, you're going to get him. But one thing they've talked about all year that they really haven't utilized a lot is him getting to the line. I mean, they're one of the worst teams in the league getting to the line before Kevin Durant got here. You know, it took a little uptick this year. They're not like top three or anything, but they've had a few games. I remember a game in Phoenix where they were really struggling. In the second quarter, I think Suns were up 10 or so, and Durant just got to the line like 12 times in a quarter and ended up having about 18 free throws in the game. And after the game, Steve Kerr's like, that is what we might need in the playoffs if it's a physical game like you're mentioning. And, you know, last year it's kind of Curry getting pushed around, Clay getting pushed around, and they stopped scoring. They stopped hitting shots. They scored under 100 points, which they never do. This year, maybe in those moments you go, you know what, ISO Durant four times. He's just going to kind of power his way into the lane, force his way to the line six times. Defense may have to ease the physicality up, and then suddenly, you know, you're running off again. So it'll be kind of interesting how they navigate those moments.
Yeah, look, and I think this is a big series for Steph Curry. You know, he's already got plenty of accolades, but, you know, when you're the star, you carry some of that responsibility of blowing a lead. And I know there were circumstances, Draymond going out in game five, but when you're the two-time MVP and you're trying to make your bones as an all-time great player, you don't blow 3-1 leads, and you don't lose two of those three games at home against the team that you've got on the ropes. I think this is a huge series for Steph.
Yeah, no doubt. And he's in a lot better place than he was last year. Curry yesterday called him, like, fresher, stronger, healthier.
Yeah, physically, yeah.
Yes. Everyone knows about the knee thing that happened. But, I mean, I think he's playing his best he's played maybe all season, you know, from a complete standpoint. He's had maybe stretches of you know, better shooting, but he's still – I think something like 45-46% from three in the playoffs. He's had incredible efficiency numbers. He's working as good as he has with Durant all season. They haven't played this well, this together at the same time. And he's getting to the rim. I mean, in the Spurs series, I can remember the closeout game four. I think he had five layups in the first quarter. And that just kind of shows you how good he's feeling physically. Plus defensively, Ron Adams, who's like the defensive guru of the Warriors, he'll tell you, like, this is the best Steph Curry's ever played defensively. It's not just steal numbers, which are high, off the ball, you know. And he's going to be needed in this series because, remember, Cleveland loves to target him. And if he can play average defensively to solid defensively, then they're, you know, fine on that end really throughout the roster.
Yeah, and offensively, I mean, they're going to get looks. I mean, the one thing I noticed took away from that Boston series was games three and the first half of game four is that when Boston moved the ball three or four times when they were channeling their inner Jimmy Chitwood there, making extra passes, they were getting easy shots. It just seemed like Cleveland's defense just gives up after you make that third pass. And you pointed out the numbers, you know, they were bottom 10 in the NBA, bottom third of the NBA, team and defensive efficiency. We've kind of forgotten about that because of how they've steamrolled through the playoffs. But in those two games at home that they played just very mediocre defensively, it was exposed. And if Boston can do it, and Boston has at that point had no real scores, if Boston can do it with that roster, I can only imagine the type of numbers that Golden State can put up if they don't get bogged down in an isolation game and just move the ball. Because Cleveland, they've only got really one plus defender. I guess Iman Shumpert is kind of a plus defender, though I don't think he's the same thing as he was before the knee surgery. But besides LeBron, there's not a deep roster of defenders. This is the type of team that I think if you're Golden State, you got to go in every night and think, I can put 115-20 on this team every single game this series.
Yeah, and, you know, that story strength. They are one of the greatest assist teams in NBA history. I think they averaged about 31 this year, and the record's 31.4, I believe, by one of the Showtime Lakers teams. They had more 30-assist games than, like, the rest of the NBA combined. Everyone can play make and pass on their team, basically, except when they put, like, a JaVale McGee on the court. But then he just becomes kind of the lottery ticket machine that just jumps up and slams down assists from everyone else. I think they can play JaVale in moments of the series, which will be interesting to follow. But, that, to me, I think is just the difference in the series is the Warriors passing and just versatility and just how everyone can pass it against a Cavs defense that by the third, fourth rotation, if they break down, I mean, it's going to be a lot of dunks and layups.
How do you think they deal with LeBron defensively? Because you can live with 25 to 30 points from LeBron. What you don't want to live with is 25 to 30 points plus 12, 13 assists plus 9, 10 rebounds. Those are the type of games where LeBron becomes that kind of big equalizer. And you know, he can just kill you with the way he plays like that.
Yeah, you know, I think they're just figuring they have the best defensive trio that you could probably think of wing-wise to at least attempt to contain LeBron. You're going to start to rain on him. Durant's a good defender, you know. He's 7 foot long, can move. If he's motivated, it means he's focused. If he's focused defensively, he's good because he has the tools to be, like, really good. And then you back that up with Andre Iguodala, who won 2015 Finals MVP, partly because of how well he played LeBron defensively. And if he's healthy, which is a concern, he was incredible in March. He's been pretty bad in playoffs, 3-27 from three. The knee's been a little bit of an issue. But if he can, you know, provide you good 15-ish minutes a night defense on LeBron, then you also have the Draymond Green card at times. I mean, he's Defensive Player of the Year. You prefer him as a help defender. It's where he's best. But just those three guys as a defensive trio, I think they're confident enough. Look, LeBron is going to get huge numbers, but like you said, not the 38, 13, 12, and, you know, just completely dominates the game.
Is there – we saw last year, and you were out in Oklahoma working out there, where, you know, there was obviously the entire direction of the Thunder franchise changed when they lost that series. Kevin Durant walked away. And it completely altered what they were trying to do. Do you think there's anything on the line here for Golden State if they lost? I mean, obviously, you've got a lot of guys still under contract, but do you think that we could see any kind of changes if they don't get through this series?
I doubt it, just because it's a kind of all been set up for them to come back, and like they feel they have a, you know, an incredible situation, and they've shown all year just how dominant they are. But, you know, losing, you know, especially because that'll – like, let's say they lost in seven, that would be on, what, like June 16th or something. That's about 15 days from free agency, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when that's still fresh in your mind, and, you know, if it goes down in a situation where, like, maybe Durant plays poorly and Draymond's yelling at him down the stretch like he did in the Memphis series, or, like, Curry's really relegated and then suddenly he's got a decision to make, at least there'd be a little bit of drama come July, because I don't think there'll be a ton, especially if they just rumble to the title. Because when they came together in the Hamptons, it was not this, like, when they were having the conversations, it wasn't, hey, let's try to really go win it next year, that'd be great. It was like, hey, let's try to build, like, a 3-4-5 year run, and from the megastars, at least. And it's so tough for me to see either Curry or Durant, and they're the only two of the big guys that can walk away this summer. I just don't see either of them doing that. So I don't think anything in the finals can change that. But like I said, you never know if something goes down kind of in a crazy way. Maybe.
All right, so that being said, what do you got for a prediction?
You know, I'm going Warriors in six. I think LeBron will get two. You know, both of the last 2 years, the road team won it on the other team's home floor. I'm going to say that's going to happen again.
All right, man. I appreciate it. I'll see you. I'm taking Warriors in five. I'm not buying the narrative right now that this is going to be the series that saves the playoffs. I don't see it. It goes back to what I was saying before. Like, I saw some exposing in that Cleveland defense in those two games against Boston. They're great offensively, and honestly, they should ask to play all their home games in Boston, given how they played there. But, like, defensively, they're vulnerable, man. Like, I'd say 115-120. I'm not kidding there. I think that can be realistic numbers for Golden State if they just play a unselfish team game, which is what Boston did. And I was watching Kelly Olynyk get layups and Terry Rozier knock down open threes. This is, you know, Kelly fucking Olynyk and Terry Rozier knocking down shots. I mean, imagine if it's Kevin Durant and Steph Curry. So I don't know. I mean, LeBron's always the great equalizer to me, but if Golden State takes these two at home, I think it ends in five.
Yeah, I think the first two are the key. I really think maybe even game one. That's the one for Cleveland to steal and put the pressure on. If they don't get that, it might, you know, turn into a snowball.
I'm with you. All right, buddy. I appreciate it, man. I'll see you out there this week.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans proudly supports the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interest in mind. And with Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial info to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. Whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/Mannix. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Joining me on the pod right now, Jason Lloyd, covers the Cavaliers for The Athletic. You can follow him on Twitter, at Jason Lloyd NBA. And my first question for you, Jason, is are you going to be wearing all black again for Game 1 like you did for Game 5 of Cavaliers-Celtics?
You know, one wardrobe malfunction, one hastily packing job later, and I'll never live that down. That was total, complete accident. I did not mean to do that until Joe Gabriel, one of the writes for the Cavs, for the Cavs, pointed out to me, complete error on my part. No, that will not happen again. Absolutely not. I'm throwing that shirt away.
That was great. I mean, that was like fodder for me because I'm bored in those situations. And you got like Tim Frank from the NBA saying, who's going to put it out there? I'm like, me. That's me. That's got me written all over it. What are you talking about? So
yeah, never again.
We use the podcast to put that out there into the universe. All right, so look, just give me a postmortem for you on the Celtics series. I mean, that was obviously a dominant, you know, series win, especially when they're on the road. I mean, that was as great a performance I've seen in three games at the Garden in a long time. But overall, your assessment of how the Cavs played in that series?
I thought they played as I expected them to, I guess, going in. You know, the Cavs, all season long, very quietly, did not care about home court advantage. And the kind of feeling, the sentiment was throughout the organization, it's not going to matter because the Celtics can't take us to a Game 7, so it won't matter. And ultimately, they proved correct. When LeBron's playing at this level, it's hard to bet against him, and that applies to any series, whether it's Eastern Conference, Finals, whatever. It's when he's playing at this level, man, he's hard to take down.
Now let me play devil's advocate here, because you go 12-1, you're obviously dominant. You're the best team in the conference by a mile. But you know, Game 3 and the first half of Game 4, the way Boston moved the ball, I thought that really, I don't want to say exposed, might be too strong a word, but something like that. That showed some vulnerabilities in that Cavs defense. And I really believe that if Marcus Smart was in better shape, if some of these Boston guys could have stuck with the game plan a little bit more, they might have had a chance to take that. I mean, Game 3 or Game 4, they're up by 16 points. Cavs had to rally there to do it. Did the Celtics show maybe some of the holes in that Cavaliers defense where they played in 3 and 4?
Well, certainly there's holes in the Cavs defense. That was proven throughout the entire regular season with the way that they defended and just the way that they like to do things. You know, the Cavs will tell you that Isaiah going out of that series really impacted the way that they wanted to defend, because they weren't really sure what Brad was going to throw at him. And they gave Brad Stevens a ton of credit for kind of changing things on the fly. And, you know, the Cavs have had a really good formula of success throughout these playoffs of, you know, blitzing the other team's best player and getting the ball out of his hands. They did it to Paul George in the first round. They did it to DeMar DeRozan in the second round. They were doing it to Isaiah in the conference finals before he went out. And when he left, they kind of had to change up what they were doing defensively. And you saw what happened in Game 3, obviously, and then the first half of Game 4. But this team just has the ability to kind of put their force and put their will and play with force against inferior teams, mm-hmm. Which, you know, the Celtics just were. And what the Pacers were when they fell behind in the first series. They fell behind huge at Indiana on the road. And then they kind of kicked it in gear. This is a team that has played lethargically at times all season long. And, you know, we thought that they had moved past that in the postseason, and then it showed up again in Game 3 where they just didn't have it. And certainly that's got to be a concern moving forward against the Warriors, because they'll be blown off the floor if that happens in the finals. You would like to think that it won't, but with this team, if there's one thing I've learned with this Cavs team, as soon as you think you've got them figured out, you don't. Mm-hmm.
So how does that defensive strategy change? Because you're right, you know, watching them play the first three rounds, it was go at Paul George, go at DeMar DeRozan, go at Isaiah Thomas. Obviously, you can't do that necessarily against Golden State with the number of players they have, two former MVPs and maybe the best shooter in basketball in Klay Thompson on the floor. I mean, how does that defensive strategy evolve?
That's one of the biggest questions of this entire series, because the Cavs have had relative success. They've had a fair amount of success against Steph Curry the first two times that they played him in the finals. He's had his moments, and he's had some big games against them, certainly. But by and large, they've done a pretty good job of neutralizing him by doing exactly what they've done to these other guys. First of all, they like to hit him. They hit him, and they hit him, and they hit him, and they're physical with him. They hit him every time he's cutting. There's a big hit in him. They like to be very physical with Steph, and they like to blitz him. And I just don't see how they can do that with Kevin Durant now on the floor. There's just too much shooting. I just don't know how they can continue to blitz the way that they did previously. So that's going to put more of an onus on Kyrie. Kyrie defensively has to step up and be the defender that he has shown in bursts at times that he can be. His defense seems to come and go at times. But I think they're going to put more of an onus on him because Tide doesn't like to use J.R. Smith on point guards. So there's not going to be a whole lot of cross-matching in the series, I don't think, whereas the Cavs have done a ton of cross-matching previously. I think when the Warrior starters are on the floor, I think it's going to be pretty straight up, where you're going to see LeBron on Kevin, JR on Clay, and Kyrie's going to have to handle Steph, and he's going to have to win that battle. He's going to have to win that positional battle in order for the Cavs to be in the series. When they start making substitutions and Amon Shumpert comes in, you might see Shump pick up Steph a little bit more, and they may have opportunities where they can still trap Steph. But it's not going to be what it was the first two times they played him. And the one we haven't even talked about yet is Draymond. Mm. And he, I think, is a huge problem in the series for the Cavs because, you know, the people will tell you, you know, last year one of the big fears throughout the regular season was, what are we going to do with Draymond? Kevin can't guard Draymond. And that still holds true. No matter how well Kevin defended Steph on that possession in Game 7 and all the credit in the world to him for it, one possession is a lot different than a seven-game series. And when the Warriors go small, they just can't put Kevin on Draymond. That's just not a good matchup for him. So now you're scrambling and now you're moving guys around. So I'm really curious to see how Ty approaches this, how they go about defending all of these weapons, because I thought in the past that they did a really nice job with it, but Kevin Durant changes everything, and they're not going to be able to blitz him the same way that they did the way that they did previously.
Yeah, we saw last year the number of open shots Harrison Barnes had and missed, and those just aren't going to be missed by Kevin Durant anywhere near as consistently. But you mentioned Kyrie, and you've covered this guy for such a long time, but to me, that game 4 that he played was the best game I've seen Kyrie Irving play. I mean, that was not only just because of the numbers he put up. I know he's had some big number games, but I consider Avery Bradley, you know, if not the one of the top 2 or 3 best defensive two guards in the NBA. And when it wasn't Bradley, it was Smart or Terry Rozier. These guys are very good defensive players, and he just destroyed them. I mean, that was something to see, Jason. It really was to watch him play like that. I mean, I think this is, you know, as great a level as some of those Warriors players are playing on right now. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what you think, but this, to me, this is the, at least offensively, as well as I've seen Kyrie Irving play.
I agree. And watching that game, the game that you referenced, the Game 4 game, reminded me of his San Antonio game. He scored 57 at San Antonio.
Yeah.
Nobody scores 57 against Pop, certainly in San Antonio. And no matter what the Spurs did to him, they couldn't stay in front of him. It didn't matter. He was hit from all over the floor. And that, I had that feeling watching him again. That was the first thing I thought of, was that San Antonio game, watching him play against Boston. And Ty has defended, you know, the Cavs revert back to a lot of isolation ball. And Kyrie and LeBron are two of the most dominant one-on-one players in the league in terms of just the numbers of possessions. And that's taken a lot of criticism over the years around here for the lack of ball movement at times and just the way that they just stand there and dribble, dribble, dribble. And Ty has defended it. He makes a delineation between good ISO and bad ISO. But when they switch, and the Warriors like to switch, if they switch on pick and rolls and they have a mismatch, Ty wants Kyrie to attack that mismatch every single time. And if that means taking 15 shots in isolation, then so be it. He'll live with the results because, well, what you just said, you know, Ty Lue says all the time, Kyrie's unguardable. There's not many players in the league who can go one-on-one better than he can. So if you're going to put him in a mismatch situation, let's attack that and go for it. So, yeah, Kyrie's going to be a huge part of the series, obviously. And like I said earlier, to me, the Cavs have to win that matchup. They have to win the Kyrie-Steph matchup. And that's a tall task when you're talking about a two-time MVP on the other side. And that's why I go back to defensively. Kyrie's going to have to give effort on the defensive end and really lock in there where, you know, in the past he's had help in that series. He's had a big coming over to help him or a switch, you know, where Shumpert or someone like that takes the point guard. And that's just not going to be an option this year, I don't think. Not as much as it was in the past. Kyrie's going to have to really own that defensive battle.
So what do they need then out of a guy like Kevin Love, who could have a few different matchups in front of him? There are going to be a lot of times that he's faced with Draymond Green. There might be times he's faced one of the Warriors' three-headed monster at center position. Maybe even times that he's engaged with Kevin Durant. What do they need from Kevin Love during this series? Because he's also another one, Jason, I think is playing probably his best basketball as a Cavalier.
Yeah, I asked him that exact question actually right before game four of the Boston series. I'm sorry, before game five of the Boston series was, you know, what is your role? Because his minutes went down drastically last year. He only played about, I think it was 26 minutes a game. He had the concussion. He missed half a game of the concussion last year in the finals. But he was averaging right around 32 and a half minutes in the Eastern Conference playoffs. And then by the finals, he was down around 26 minutes. And, you know, it wouldn't fully shock me if that happens again. Ty said he would hope that that's not the case, that he can stay on the floor more. But I just wonder if his minutes will go down again. In the finals. But he said he had to play more of a Tristan role where he has to set hard screens. Rebounding is huge. He really has to punish them in rebounding. He had a nice game in game seven. I think he had 14 rebounds off the top of my head. I can't remember exactly, but I think he had 14 rebounds in game seven. Kevin has to punish them in rebounding and on threes. And he can't miss. And he had said that. He said, you know, when my opportunities are there, I have to take full advantage of them. So I don't know if he's going to play quite the Kevin games that he's had previously, how he normally plays in this. But, you know, if he only gets four or five shots, he has to make those. And I know it kind of goes without saying, but against this team in particular, everything is amplified. And if you have if you're having a bad shooting night and he's not rebounding, then he's not very much of help to them in this series. So that's why he really needs to punish them with what he does best, and that's rebounding and shooting open threes.
Yeah, punish is the right word because, to me, I think that Cleveland's got to muck this series up a little bit. If you look at the physicality scale, it tilts pretty heavily in their favor. I mean, they've got, you know, Tristan Thompson, they've got LeBron, they've got Kevin Love, they've got guys that can muscle you in the paint. Whereas if you look at the other side of the ledger, it's Draymond Green, it's to some degree, you know, the David Wests of the world coming off the bench. But the physical side of it, I think they've got to make it almost a street fight, Jason, because if you get into this kind of free-flowing game with Golden State, you're going to get blown out. It's just, you're just not going to beat that team with Kevin Durant on it in a three-point shooting contest. It's just not going to work. I mean, they've got to, you know, get to the free throw line and just turn this game into just an all-out war in the paint to win, in my opinion.
Well, if you remember back, that's exactly what they did 2 years ago when it was LeBron and not much else around them. They just beat the hell out of Golden State. That's how they beat them. They just went all physical on them. Dele played himself to exhaustion. Obviously, he's not here anymore, but he played himself onto a stretcher and into a hospital with an IV. But they just wore on them, and they hammered them and hammered them and hammered them. And I tend to agree. I thought they got away from that a little bit early in the last series. And I thought I didn't think last year ever reverted to what it was 2 years ago. I didn't think it ever got to that level of physicality, but I thought that they did get a little bit tougher in 5, 6, and 7 for obvious reasons. But I remember, I think probably was when they went down 3-1, talking to Ty, walking back to the locker room with them. And I said, you know, last year you guys just beat the hell out of them, and that's not happening. And he kind of agreed and said, we have to be tougher. And again, I don't think it ever reached the level it did 2 years ago. The level of physicality in that series 2 years ago was remarkable to me. The way that it just seemed evident from the start, the Cavs' plan was, we're just going to beat them down. And like you said, we're going to ugly it up, muck it up, and just be physical with them. And I think that's the best. I'm not going to say the Warriors are soft, but I don't think that they want to play that physical style of banging every time. So there are certainly opportunities there for the Cavs. If anyone outside of Cleveland, you know, I certainly would pick the Warriors, and I understand why. But having seen this team all year long, like I said at the start, I have a hard time betting against LeBron just with seeing at the level that he's playing at and knowing that what this team is capable of when they're locked in and focused. I mean, let's be honest, they've been thinking about the Warriors for the last 365 days. Mm-hmm. Certainly you would think that they'll be locked in and focused for the next 7 games.
All right, so you mentioned LeBron, and you brought this up to him after Game 5 in Boston. Great golf analogy, by the way, in that question you had for LeBron. You know, he's obviously up there, in my opinion anyway, he's up there in the rarefied air of Jordan. Like, what he's done individually, the number of championships he's already got. I never bought into the whole 6-0 Jordan mystique because I think that that's too simplistic. It doesn't take into account the teammates that you have, the situations you're in, how many times you're favored in a finals versus the opposite. But this is, I mean, this would be this is a massive moment for LeBron James. He is going up against a basketball Voltron, a team assembled to be the most dominant team in the NBA, a 73-win team that added a top five player. If the Cleveland wins this series, what does this do for LeBron, in your opinion?
I mean, I still say we have to wait and let him finish his career and see how it all plays out. But boy, I thought 1-1 in Cleveland is worth two elsewhere, just to start. Mm-hmm. Just to come in and do what he did last year. To come back from 3-1 down, to break the 52-year drought of the city. All of that. To me, that's worth two, if not three. And I don't think I'm overstating that. Just you have to understand the history of Cleveland to understand what that's worth. So if he does that, if he comes in and pulls this off and does this again, to me, and of course, maybe I am a little biased because I'm with him every day and I see him every day. But yeah, I think he overtakes Michael, and I don't say that lightly. And I try not to say that as a prisoner of the moment, and not and having full respect for what Michael did in his career, because I was a kid watching him in awe, thinking that could never be topped. But just seeing what LeBron, the way that he goes about it, the way that he carries himself, the way that he handles his business, and the way that he performs on the court, if he's able to pull this off, to me, that would put him ahead of Michael. Is he there now? You know, that's for the eye of the beholder, and I can understand why people would say no. But I agree with you. The one thing you said about the 6-0 mark of Michael, that's almost like – and LeBron was dangerously close to a 2-5 finals mark last year, and mm-hmm. 3-4 looks a lot better than 2-5. But that's almost like punishing – you're punishing a guy for making it. You know, I don't think that's necessarily fair that you punish a guy for getting there and failing to win, because – so the alternative is better to lose in the first round or the second round? That doesn't equate to me. That doesn't quite make sense. So I just think if he can pull this off, to me, he's ahead of Michael.
You're around this guy every day, Jason. How long do you think that LeBron can play at this level? Because if you look at the history of high school guys, now is the time when they start to break down. The Kobe's, the Jermaine O'Neal's. You start to see the nagging injuries. LeBron... you just don't. I mean, he's had the back problem in the past, but he is the best player on the planet right now. I don't even think it's all that close. I mean, how long do you think this continues for LeBron? Because I agree with you. You can't have any real discussion about the greatest of all time until the career is complete. But when does that happen for LeBron? Is it 36, 37, 38? Do you see him playing? Do you see him having like a Tom Brady type of career playing into his 40s?
Well, I've had a lot of discussions with him about that, actually, off and on. And, you know, I've kicked around the idea if he would ever want to play with LeBron Jr. someday, and he would have to play the year 21. Because, you know, at this point, I don't think there's any doubt at the trajectory he's on, not to put too much undue pressure on a kid that's, you know, his age, that's not even in high school yet. But, you know, all signs are pointing to LeBron Jr. is going to be an NBA player at some point. And I said, would you ever want to play with him? But that would be year 21. And, you know, he's at year 14 now, and I don't think that's unheard of. For him to make it to year 21, particularly at this level. When he came back to Cleveland, the Cavs thought he had four prime years left. And, you know, here we are, and he's still as good as he's ever been. And I asked him, I think we were in Toronto, and I said, is there anything physically that you could do 10 years ago that you cannot do now? And he said no, and that's terrifying to think of. He's as explosive now at 32 as he was at 22. It takes him longer to recover now. And he may have to ice more often, and there's more treatment involved and everything else. But when he's on the floor, he feels like he can do everything now that he could do 10 years ago. And the difference with him, obviously, is his mind. He's not scared anymore. He's not, you know, I think there was a point in his career where you could say he was afraid of the moment. That's not true anymore. And he understands the game at a level that few others do. And when you combine his courage, I guess, for lack of a better word, or his the fact that he's not afraid anymore, with the way that he can process and understand the game, with the athleticism, you know, unless he just falls off a cliff where he just comes back one year and just doesn't have his fastball anymore, I think at least he's got one or two more years left at this level, if not more. And I don't want to shortchange the guy, because like I said, the Cavs thought he had four prime years left, and he's showing like he's not slowing down anytime soon. And it's remarkable to be 32 years old and still playing at the level that he is. I think he's surpassed all expectations in terms of that.
That would be awesome to see him playing with his son, like a Griffey moment in baseball.
Right, right.
I never thought of that. That would be something. I mean, that would be the final page maybe on his greatest of all time resume. Because if he goes seven more years, Jason, if he's playing at a high level, we're not even having this discussion. We're not. It's just if he's at 21 years, five championships, and all the numbers he'd put up, I mean, there's no way we're having this discussion. He's the greatest.
Well, and that's what RJ's, Richard Jefferson's point was after the Boston series was, you know, RJ was definitive, and he said, this record will never be broken. The postseason scoring mark will never be broken because of where he's at now. And you got to think, you know, he's got a couple more, obviously, playoff runs in him, certainly, to keep adding to this mark. And, you know, RJ's point was someone's got to go play 10 years and get to the finals every year. Like, that's not going to happen. This just isn't going to happen again. So, yeah, I mean, just no matter what you say about the guy, it's not – you can't overstate what he's done to me. The 7 straight finals appearances, say what you want about the East and the competition level of the East and everything else, to do what he's done, to take 2 separate franchises to 4 straight finals – or not straight, but to 4 finals total, it's been extraordinary to watch.
All right, so before I let you go, your prediction for this series.
That's so hard, and everyone keeps asking me that. But, you know, like I said, anyone outside of Cleveland probably does and should take the Warriors. And even people in Cleveland, if they're honest with themselves, may take the Warriors. But I just have a hard time betting against LeBron. That is the – just for everything that we've said, everything that we've talked about for the last few minutes here, is why I just don't know how you beat that guy 4 times in a series. And I know how close the Warriors came last year, and I'm on the side that if Draymond is not suspended, that series is over in 5. I don't think there's any doubt in my mind the Cavs lose that game at Golden State in game 5 if Draymond's on the floor. But he wasn't, and we saw what happened. And that has only added to LeBron's confidence level, if you will. And the Cavs just aren't scared of this team. And very few teams can say that. And, you know, I was in Ty Lue's office the other day, and I said, and I've used this many, many times, but to me, most teams, when they walk out on the floor, are in a 6-0 hole to the Warriors just from an intimidation factor alone. And that's rare in this league where everybody's confident, everybody knows they belong. But to me, it's 6-0 Warriors every time they step out on the floor. And Ty laughed and said it may even be higher than that. But there, to me, there's 3 teams in the league that just aren't scared of Golden State. That's San Antonio, Cleveland, and Memphis. Those 3 are just grizzled veteran teams that believe in their system. They believe in what they do, and they will attack the Warriors and go right at them. LeBron does not fear the Warriors. He does not fear Kevin Durant. He doesn't care that Kevin Durant went to Golden State. That means, like, it really, like, it's not a disrespectful thing. He just doesn't think anyone can beat him. So, and he said the other day he was very confident, and, like, he was almost insulted by the question. What do you mean, how do I feel about my odds going in? I'm very confident. As he should be. So for that reason, I'll take the Cavs. And it's not because I cover them, but it's, I guess, because I see them every day. And I know what he's capable of doing. And like I said, I just don't know how you slay that monster 4 times. So I think it's going to be an incredible series. And it wouldn't surprise me if the Cavs get their doors blown off in game 1. Like, that win totally shocked me. If Golden State boat races them and wins by 25 or 30, it's not going to change my mind. I still think over the course of a 7-game series, I just don't know how you take that guy down 4 times.
Should be fun, man. Jason, I appreciate you coming on the podcast here. I'll see you out there this week.
All right, Chris, thanks.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Bobby Marks, Anthony Slater, and Jason Lloyd for joining the show. As always, you can download archive podcasts on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, leave a comment, post a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.